Good evening, Strong Stance listeners. This is your host, Eli Strong, and I have another Spotlight episode for you. I always love these episodes because I get to showcase yet another person in our brilliant community of trans and gender nonconforming and non-binary lives. My guest on this episode is Kendra Brill. Kendra is a transgender prison reform activist, advocate, and motivational speaker. She's recently published a book with Testa Carlo detailing her path through substance abuse, 2 years in prison, transition, name change, legal battles, and finding and claiming her faith. So, Kendra, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. Very, very blessed.
Well, I want to, before we even get to, you know, one of the big things that, of course, I want to talk about tonight is your book and your faith and kind of what that path was like and how you got to that. But before we do that, I really just want to kind of give the listeners an idea about your background. So, you know, tell our listeners something about yourself. Where'd you grow up? What was your youth like or anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, a lot of that childhood stuff is real raw and hard for me. I was the product of an affair my mother had. So pretty much my life, my existence on this earth has been a lie at the expense of sin and my own family members, my birth father and mother. So I didn't find out till 13. I had a stepfather who was in the military who raised me very, very strongly, very much tried to make a man out of me, toughen me up, I guess. I wasn't his child, so he could do whatever he wanted. I found peace in just being alone because there was really no safe place for a person like me, a different person. I knew that there was something different about me. I think the first revelation in my life was the fact that I wasn't born in the right gender. My sex organ didn't match what my mind is. So now I see Jazz Jennings and all these children in the National Geographic that are so young doing it. I'm like, wow, they are brave. The world was different in the 80s. And, you know, I had no real strong support system, maybe because I didn't reach out. I had my grandmother. I had her, and I lived 600 miles from her. So I guess I lived in fear. I lived in fear pretty much my entire childhood, but there were happy moments, of course. There were moments of joy, but they were short-lived because I was always in fear of people finding me out, and I was afraid that if they knew, I thought my father, like my stepfather, I thought he would really, truly, I hate to say this, but he used to tell me that faggots get buried in the backyard. So it was a thought that I always was scared, and if anybody had called me a faggot or something like that, I'd freak. Because it was the bullying in school, and then I'd come home to the alcoholic mom who was always cheating on. It was the infidelities, and I was growing so much faster than I had to ever just to make sure my little sister was okay. It was very hard, and I take every bit of it, and I molded it into the woman that I am today so that I can help the youth. That's where it's at, the youth. That's where it's at, the babies. They need to know it's okay, safe. We're here for you.
Yeah. What was your, so did you have any kind of form of support network? I mean, you mentioned your grandmother, but other, like, including her, what was your support network like then? Did you have one at all?
My sister, my little sister, Amber, she was born with congenital heart disease. So that put a real big hold on the way I thought. I had to protect her. So no matter what, I sacrificed myself at the expense of her condition. And taking care of her and keeping her away from the chaos, anything that could stress her heart out or anything that could cause her any kind of, you know, complications with her issue. And that was my support. Plus, I had so many friends on the street. We lived in a really nice suburban neighborhood in Charleston, South Carolina. My stepfather was in the military, and he was gone a lot. So when my mom, you know, when he was gone, my mom was real wild, and she was out there still doing things that I knew that she shouldn't be doing, that he would never, ever, ever. So she taught me how to be a good liar. She taught me how to be a drunk. She taught me how to be a whore. She taught me how to be a lot of things that I always told her I'd never be like her. And if I didn't come out like her, I mean, I came out to be just almost very similar to her. She taught me all the bad stuff that put me in prison, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I no respect for authority, none whatsoever. I was angry, though. By the time that stuff started happening, I was trying to kill myself. Pretty much similar to like Amy Winehouse or a celebrity that drank themselves to death. I didn't want to wake up. I was tired, but I knew better than to kill myself. I knew that there was something greater than me. I hated God for a long, 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 long time. He wasn't in my vocabulary the way he is now. I conditioned myself. I fell in love. I fell in love in the penitentiary. I think it was the first love that ever, ever, ever meant anything to me. And a great love that caused me a lot of problems after we were released from prison.
Well, definitely. So you mentioned prison. Correct me if I'm wrong. You spent 2 years in a men's prison. Is that correct?
I actually did the jail thing. You know, when you start out in the life of crime, it's always petty at first. It was for me. I didn't have no serious immediate charges that sent me right to the penitentiary. It was the petty drinking stuff, the drinking and driving, the DUIs, which thank God that I never hurt nobody. I never killed nobody. I am so against drunk driving right now that I advocate for that, even though it might make me look like a hypocrite because I've had 4 DUIs, but my birth father has same problems. The apple don't fall far from the tree, no matter how much disconnect is there. I hadn't seen my birth father. I never knew him. I found him at 16, and he was no better than anything that I ever could have imagined him being. Through the search for him, I just thought I had a father out there that was going to love me for me, and I was sadly, sadly mistaken for that. He was just like a monster, like my mom. So my grandfather, he died. He said his worst regret ever in his whole entire life was handing me back to my teenage mother. She wanted to give me to them and leave and go to South Carolina with Joe, my stepfather, and he's no longer in her life. But that's my sister, Amber, my half-sister. That's her father. And she wanted to go to South Carolina. And he told her, no, you made your bed, lay in it, because they all wanted her to get an abortion. And I ask her sometimes, why didn't you just do it? If you ain't going to love me and you're going to tell me you hate me, why didn't you just go ahead and do it? Because you didn't give me nothing easy, but what she did was make me fearless in just everything I do, the compassion that I have for just humanity. And it's just so much more than the LGBT community. It's even more widespread. The activism, the things that I'm involved in, the church, and being a public figure for the transgender community and properly representing a community that's pretty misunderstood by false media or people getting out there and writing lies and just not really having the good intentions of telling the truth. You start talking about certain things like God and it scares people. That's not what I want. That's not what my ministry does. We're trying to fix the damage. We want to fix the damage of the church. God loves us. I lived in my life thinking God hated me because that's what everybody used to tell me. And I was pretty much a slave, and I never saw a light. So I pretty much made it to where I had an affair, a love affair with the devil, and he was my husband for a long time. Like, I loved sin, and I loved the wages of it, and I loved the brutality of it. I learned to love pain, and I wore it like, you know, a sheath, a beautiful dress, or I just wore it well. And it was always like, wow, I was always labeled as weak. As a child, weak, you're weak, you're weak, you're nothing. All these things, you're a loser. All the things that the people I loved to death were telling me I became because it hurt me. And I didn't know why they were so mean, but I come to find out later in life that life is a funny way of bringing you around full circle. So my mother's still the same exact way that she was. As far as I can remember, the first grade, I think, is when I lost her to her spiritual death. And I haven't seen her since, and I'm 36, so that's a long time.
It is. And I think that one thing that is very clear in reading some of your posts and on Facebook and your pages is that you put a lot of value in your relationship with God. And look, you mentioned that you kind of hated God for a long time. And I think that even people that have a relationship with whoever they see as their creator, that have faith, they still struggle with different episodes of anger or of resentment. And so I wonder, have you always been a person of faith, or has that just come about as a result of your experiences?
That has come about as a result of my experiences. My God, you know, I was in the men's penitentiary. I had my head shaved bald. I had the worst fear of this situation ever happening in my life, even as a child. My mother used to ride by a prison, and I used to look at them guys, and I was scared of them because I knew that they could see through that. I knew that anybody could see through that if they took enough time. And I tried really hard to hide and in the shadows or behind walls to be overlooked in school because I didn't want to be that target. I didn't want to be the one that somebody could get jokes off on. And it happened and it hurt me so bad. So I pretty much made my routine to avoid a lot of people because it, you know, people are mean, especially children, especially back then. And now we have all these suicides. We have all these problems. I guess it's gotten worse. I don't know. The fear.
I think it's also that we're in a digital age where we hear about a lot more of it as well, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you always hear about murder on the news, but they don't, out of respect for families and things like that, very often there aren't reports on the news or often about suicides necessarily. That has, I believe, come about a lot more when it's when we kind of report it ourselves and we hold the media accountable for reporting it, particularly when it comes to suicide being a result of kind of the things that a particular community is going through. I can totally see why lots of people are like, is it worse or is it not? Who knows, right? We see a lot more because I believe because of social media being the nature that it is, that we know things in like milliseconds as opposed to days. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I definitely kind of agree with you on that. So were you already identifying, whether publicly or at least to yourself, as a woman when you went into the men's prison, or did you just know you were kind of different, you weren't quite in the right body, but not sure what it was? Were you already identifying as a woman going into a men's prison? And by the way, the reason why I ask is because there are a lot of people that kind of, you know, they spend time in a prison and it's not the prison, it's just part of coming of age that you kind of realize, oh, this is what I'm feeling. But then there are other people that are like, I've been put in the wrong prison because I am a woman, but the law states XYZ and will not allow me to be in a women's prison or a men's prison for trans men. So were you already identifying as a woman when you went in, or was that come about during or after?
I think that a lot of the people that were influential in my attempted sobrieties and relapses and probation officers that were there from the really petty charges that became bigger and bigger,
mm-hmm.
they knew that I was different. I was so effeminate, I couldn't hide it. I tried to portray myself as a homosexual man, and I was an advocate for the LGBT in the 90s. I was very visible at 16 in a school of 400 country people who never met anything like me before in their life, and they see mm-hmm. me to this day. And I live in a really small community, Shenandoah County, rural Shenandoah County in Virginia. Lots of farms, lots of mountains, lots of land, and lots of brokenness right now with this heroin epidemic that I'm advocating for as well, because I've lost 9 of my dearest, most intimate using partners, ex-lovers, and everything to this within this last year. That's humiliating, and it's also humbling, and I've grown. Now I have an army of angels, I believe. But, you know, life is what you make it. I believe in a positive way. I've seen the negative. I have lived 30 years of my life as what everybody else wanted me to be. And my breakthrough revelation was out sitting in the penitentiary, just looking around me, realizing how lonely I was in the world, not getting visits, not getting money sent in, not getting letters, not being able to make phone calls to my family, and completely feeling abandoned and very angry because, wow, I spent the last 30 years of my life being what I thought you wanted me to be instead of being what I should have been all along. And that is my breakthrough revelation as far as this. I portrayed myself as a gay guy. I thought I could be, you know, in a relationship with a more masculine gay guy, but no. It was never happy. I was always angry, and I was hard to love because, you know, the brokenness that laid within me, my jail bids, they started to turn longer. And then when mm-hmm. I got this fourth DUI, I don't know how it happened. I just escaped. I got lost in the world, and I wandered to a person who I thought was my friend, and she allowed me to drive her car to go on a crack run. And I had taken Xanaxes and had been drinking with her, and she was out there too. And that's why I guess we related, a common bond, pain. And she allowed me to take her car to a strange city, Roanoke, Virginia. I had no idea where I was, and I just fell asleep, and I crashed into a ditch, pretty much. I just pulled off the side of the road and fell asleep, and the officers came to the window, and that was the moment in my life where I knew that I just brought back the same exact charge. I had just been sent home from a third DUI. I'd done 15 months in the county jail. I knew I was going to be doing a little bit of time. So right there through booking, I let go and let God. And I said, you know, it's going to be the time where I'm just going to start dealing with it. And I'm going to start living my truth. And it's going to start now. And I'm going to live it. And I came home as a woman from the penitentiary. So my grandparents, my mother, my family, they lost their whatever they son or grandson or Will, William. They lost them to that. And I came home as Kendra, all because of my grandfather's voice resonating in my head saying one night to me, Kendra, or he didn't call me Kendra then, but he calls me Kendra now, even from heaven. I just know. I can hear him, you know.
Yeah.
He's guiding me.
Yeah.
And it was the first death I even experienced at 35 years old. That was the first taste of death, which even changed me more. Yeah, because I didn't know. I was playing with life, taking it for granted. I had all this life with everyone, never feeling death. And he told me, I know you didn't choose to do this to hurt anyone. I know that it was just in you, pretty much giving me a subliminal as to, like, maybe even him having some of the same issues as me, because it never was. It felt like that sometimes with him. It felt like he was trying to let me know that you're no different, you know? And that's what got me through. And that is really pivotal, that this man loved me the whole time. I couldn't see it because I was afraid of men. I was terrified of him.
Right.
I was terrified.
Which must have made, you know, your time in a men's prison even harder. So I know that you started hormones while in prison. What was your transition process at that beginning of your transition process like while you were on the inside?
I had wrestled with the notion for a while, and I fell in love with a man named Terrence Myrick. They called him T-Mac. He had done a lot of time in and out of prison. He had a good reputation of never messing around with what they call a boy, a punk, a gum.
Mm-hmm.
They have terminologies that are really rude for you if you're in there. He was a true boss, and his father was a minister. And he saw me in a storm. This is what he tells me. I saw you in a storm, and I reached for you because I watched you before you even knew I was watching you. And he did. And I fell in love with him in there very, very quickly. And our love affair lasted 2 years, and it was very public in front of the officers. I had maintained a level of respect in there because I gave it. The men in there, I was in a low-level prison. Thank goodness that helped, because receiving was the scariest thing I ever been through in my life. And that's just the central hub of when you're about to go and get shipped to your penitentiary in the state of Virginia. They classify you, and you end up going to whatever prison that your level qualifies you for. Well, mine was the very lowest level, and it was a sentence that I took to do a program for 2 years, and then 2 years got taken off of my sentence. So I was scheduled to come home on June 1st of 2016, but I completed my program, and I came home on October 24th of 2014. And yes, in the penitentiary, when I walked up to the psychologist, I had to learn the difference between them too. He was walking on the boulevard, which is like this long sidewalk that separates right between the middle of the penitentiary. And I caught him, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I just said, you know what, just say it. And it was on my heart. I was led to him. And I felt like he might have had some kind of, maybe I thought he was also a gay man. I just felt like I could talk to him. So I walked up. I said, Dr. Brockington, I have a serious issue. I feel like a woman, and I felt like a woman the whole time. And they're beating this into my head, asking me what is wrong that keeps me coming back into the system with the alcohol and the addiction. And I was like, I know that this is it. So he called me down. Very lovely. Called me to his office like not even a day later. And he had information. What I thought was gender identity disorder had become gender dysphoria. And he wanted me to know the difference. So he said, take this all back. And here's a highlighter. And I'm going to call you back down in like 2 or 3 days, highlight what pertains to you, and we'll talk. So I did all of that. And then I went back to his office, and he has some tests sitting out. And they're the MMPI 1 and 2 testing to gauge a lot of different things psychiatrically, not just gender, but the whole spectrum. Yeah. And I took my test, and then I waited forever for the results to come back. But the results had to be overseen by the psychiatrist, not him. But he was able to explain it to me. And when he showed me the test, he did a man test and a woman test, male and woman, male and female. And the craziness of that was just the way that the lines went for the male were peaks and valleys and just so distorted. And when he showed me the woman, it was completely like straight, like with a little hills, but not no great big peaks, but just it was the eye opener for me. And he explained it. He said there's a conflict that the way you look out of the world through your eyes and the way the world looks back for you and perceives you, because they don't see who you really are. And that's why your addiction is very highly gauged on the male test. So it was a lot of testing. They didn't just, you know, the Department of Corrections is going to be thorough. They have a thing where you have a jacket, a sleeve, and it follows you. Even if I ended up back, which I know that is not part of my future, but if I ended up, it would follow me. And even for my probation officers, it follows me back to the courts. And I was so happy for that, because then I knew that the judge would be able to see it and I'd be able to get my name changed. And boy, was that a slap in my face. And that taught me a whole nother lesson about life. And all I had done in the penitentiary, I publicly walked amongst the masses of 1,000 men as myself in a therapeutic community as a cadre, which is the highest achieving position that an inmate can have, almost like an officer. And I could go into buildings and do therapy with men because they respected me. If I walked into a dorm, the dorm would shut up. If the dorms were rowdy, they'd ask me to go and live in the dorms until the dorm calmed down, because the presence of me calmed people down. And the guards would laugh about it. And, you know, it was just crazy. But the way they handled me through the system, I have met some real, real, real people, correctional officers, who they really do care. They really do. They weren't rude. There were some rude, disrespectful ones that would dead name me or call me Mr. on purpose. That childish stuff, but I never fed into it. I never did. I was taught very well by the guy I dated. I have his name tattooed on my arm still. We're not together, but he gave me gifts. He taught me about the Lord and putting God first. And I was so desperate at first for protection, but then I fell in love with him, and I still love him to this day. For just giving me that knowledge and showing me what the Lord was and taking me to the church, because really we didn't stay in the same dorm. They wouldn't keep us there, but they kept us together in the same building, but the buildings were split A side and B side. So if I was on A, he was on B, but they kept him with me because I was a liability. I mean, if anything would have happened to me, they didn't want that. So I was always right up front, or I was always monitored, especially after the hormones. They made me take a shower, like go knock on the booth and tell them, I'm going to take my shower so that they can be on alert, because the guys in there was real rude, really rude, and they would gun me down, and they were really, really, really nasty with the perversion.
Well, so you mentioned hormones. So they allowed you through those with all those tests and all that. Did they provide you with hormones? What kind of hoops did you have to jump through in order to get to be able to start HRT? Like, was that something that you had to pay for yourself? Was that something that the state of Virginia in, you know, the corrections system paid for? Like, how does that work? Because I know that a lot of people are, you know, different states, it's different places, right? And there are people right now that were on hormones and go in and the prison refuses to give them their hormones, even though they've been on them for years. And then there's people that are allowed to, like, have different kinds of clothing, but they refuse to let them start on hormones. And so you have a very interesting story that you actually started while you were in prison. So I was just wondering how that kind of came to pass.
Well, Dr. Travis Lee is my hero. And against all odds and against what the penitentiary contracted position that he worked in for whoever the subcontracted medical company was at that time, because there were multiple, he didn't care. He knew my heart. He listened to me. I got to become friends. He started me on the HRT, which I think got him in a lot of trouble. I really, truly do.
Okay.
He no longer works with the Department of Corrections. He actually has a practice down in Virginia Beach, and he's got a bunch of stuff for transgender as far as, I guess maybe there's a hormone cream now, and he wanted me to come down there and advertise it for him and try it out. And I was like, that's not something I'm opposed to doing, because you are the pivotal, you know, you're the guy that really, he blessed me. And yeah, the hormones started, and even the nurses were like, they prescribed you hormones? Oh my God, you know, like rude. And they were rude. The women were the worst, especially the women officers. They were the rudest to me because of my transition. But I went through so many petty things. The pettiness really molded me to learn to pick and choose my battles wisely. But yes, Dr. Travis Lee, he is amazing. To this day, he's my friend on Facebook. He's the one that started my journey in HRT, and I love him, and he knows that I do, and he told me about the system and what they were trying to do and push him out, but he was fighting back. I guess he said whatever. He didn't care. He was going to treat the patient because of his heart and his compassion, and he didn't care who he was working for. He knew that I needed that to be healthy.
So did you have difficulty readjusting to life after you were released? I mean, I know that some people kind of get, as much as they may not want to, they get, you know, accustomed to being in that regimented an environment, whether it's the military or in jail or whatever. And so I was just wondering if you had any kind of difficulty readjusting to life after you were released.
Yes, I didn't last very long. I had every desire on reducing my own recidivism and getting my name changed and getting a job and making money and paying fines and being productive. But the judge didn't allow me to do that. He denied my name change. I was with my grandfather. We rode by the courthouse. He said, why don't you go on in there and change your name? He knew how much it meant to me. I'd only been home for 2 days. They were helping me get reestablished and trying to accept me, and everything was good until I got the letter in the mail that said denial. And I couldn't find hormones in my community. And I was like defeated, and I had to fight, and I was searching. I couldn't find anybody. The way I got hormones was actually very wrong. Like, one of my transgender friends of 20 years, I knew who her doctor was, and I snaked her. I called over her, but I don't know why she wouldn't let me. I guess she figured it was something that was private between her and him, because they had been working together for years and years, but I had no other choice. I was so desperate, and I didn't have any more left from whatever the prison sent me home with. And I just had my name change denied. But what had happened was I went to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and I talked to the woman, and I told her what had happened. And she said, here, sign this paper. It was a gender marker change. She said, turn this in immediately. And I did it. And for a long time, I was William as a female on my ID. And I lived like that for 2 years since I came home, because I fought the system. I fought relapse, and I turned back into a prostitute, and I was selling my body, and I was drinking and using drugs, and I tried to kill myself twice, because I felt like all the time that I invested in my own recovery was just stolen from me by this judge discriminating against me, because he told me to come back after I got gender reassignment surgery because I was a felon for nonviolent crimes, nonviolent. Mm. Nothing I had was violent, or it was about recidivism and saving me and letting me be myself authentically. He could have called me back in the courtroom and explained it and looked at me. But no, I broke the law. I broke the law, and I stole $2 beer just so I could go right before the man, so he could see me. And I allowed him to humiliate me in and out of courtroom appearances for a long, long time, and fought with public defenders. Then I started reaching out to the transgender, and they started blessing me on GoFundMe with money to obtain a hired attorney. And all these beautiful things started happening. And I was like, how can I not say God ain't real? Look at all these people working for me and moving these mountains with me. And I stayed very strong in my faith and my word and my commitment. but what it was that got me sober again to fight these battles. Usually, you know, anytime I ever had court, I was drinking or getting messed up the night before, but not me, not no more, not after that. But a couple weeks before that, I had done an interview with the Northern Virginia Daily, and I confessed my sin, my guilt, my story very publicly. And you can look at the picture there and see that 2 years ago, I was broken. I had just came home from jail. The reporters met me. My grandfather was coming home from the hospital. He had gotten his cancer back within 2 months after a huge $200,000 surgery, after they promised him that the cancer was gone. It was like a game. It was like one thing after the other. And I just fought, and I fought, and I fought, and I fought. And then I started to realize the lessons that I learned from Terrence in the penitentiary. And then I met Trudy Kitzmiller, and she was just from on the other side of the mountain in West Virginia. And she had just took on her state for discriminating against her at the Department of Motor Vehicles. And her judge gave her the name change, but when she went to get her with, you know, her ID, they were trying to make her take her wig off, her makeup, her jewelry, everything humiliated her. So she met the Transgender Legal Education and Defense Fund, and then she gave that gift to me when she saw me struggling in the media. And then my grandmother and her met each other, and my grandmother pretty much said, you need to go be with Trudy, because Trudy was fighting loneliness. She says the day that I met her, she had a loaded 9/11 shotgun, not a shotgun, but a pistol. And she was going to kill herself until she saw that I was so close. I had like popped right up on her screen, and I was like, wow, that's weird. If that's a true story, and you really – really truly happened, then wow, you know. And then I met her son, and her son, he's got autism and diabetes and Asperger's, and he's 15, and I just fell in love with his soul and his sweetness and his non, like, he's never really, he doesn't really know what life is really truly about, and that this is a really hard world. But he said, Kendra, you're always drinking when I see you. And those words just hurt me enough to stop and really think about what I was doing. And I started fighting, and I fought victoriously, and I won. I won. I won every battle, everything that stood before me. I won it. And it was doctors that were sending letters to this judge telling him why this is crucial for me. And he still denied it again and had a little smartness to it. Like, I don't understand why I'm seeing this. I've already made my decision. Well, it was until Allison Toep from Richmond and Reed Smith, who is a partner with the Transgender Legal Education and Defense Fund. She came in there, and, you know, my town's so small. She's not from here. She looks like $1 million. And she walks right in there. She's just so different. And he's just so, like, I don't think that he thought I had it in me. But I learned how to fight in prison. I learned how to reach out. Yeah. I learned how to scream help if I needed it. And I stopped taking no for an answer. And I stopped letting people try to tell me who I was. I don't care if you're a judge or not. You're not going to tell me who I am. Nobody on this planet but God. And God knows who I am. And if the whole transgender thing was such a big deal and I was condemned and going to hell, well, why in the world am I blessed? Why do I have family? I have family waiting for me on the other side of this wall right now that I'm, you know, just blessed. And I have love. And I have these youth that reach out that are like my children. And a family so big, and it's growing every day, and people are coming back into my life and wanting to help because they want people to hear what I have to say. They say, what you say, Kendra, is powerful stuff. And the way I talk is nothing in comparison to the person that I used to be. If you look on my previous page where I was William and living, and I still have that page for a reason. I go back, it's like looking through the graveyard, the posts that I used to write that were just stupid. They're all cries, please, for help. And then the woman that I had become, way, way, way different, way different. And I believe the hormones helped, God helped, love helped, death helped. Overdoses are happening left and right in my community, people you never thought. I've got a world of just chaos around me, and I'm sitting here living in the light. Finally, while everybody who used to live in the light while I was in the dark is dying or they're in dark, they're broken. And it's just a complete parallel, and it's very hard for me to swallow.
So, I mean, listen, you have been through some, you know, amazing experiences. There's a lot of people in our community that are also going through similar experiences. And, I mean, I don't know whether that's what kind of maybe pushed you towards writing, you know. So tell folks about this great book that you just recently came out with.
The Kendra Brill story is pretty much the eye-opening revelation of being able to see the world in the supernatural out of my third eye, because I was in such fight or flight that I had to always be on guard because I never knew what was going to come around. So I had to learn how to read people, really, truly read them. And I started seeing things in people, and I started going to church every day in the penitentiary, and my faith got strong, and I was able to quote scripture, and I was able to sing church music and all that. That was, you know, the place that I went to get away from the prison life is to the church. And I felt like a phoenix, the bird that just died. And I've died, and I've been given a new life, and it's changed. I don't have I'm not a Christian. I'm just a spiritual woman that does believe that Jesus died on the cross, and that does believe is that that's God's son, and he was sent here. And, yeah, I do believe all of that. And it works. It's the only thing that works for me. And it does. It works. Mm-hmm. It works. And I'm not going to let nobody judge me, because that's what I hate about our community is the judgments. I don't like people that want to be accepted, but you're going to judge me because of my religion. There are so many issues with labels and just the way that the word, the LGBT, just got so like A, B, C, D, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, P. Okay, it's just too much. Like, you're a human being. You're a person. That's how I look at you. I don't look at who you sleep with. I don't look at the color of your skin. I have no prejudices whatsoever. The only thing I don't like is hatred. That's it. I hate hatred. I don't hate nothing but hatred. I hate it. And I see it. I just, it's just so much. And really, it's just a lot of brokenness. My book, though, had turned into pretty much like the chapters. They really got Tess. Tess is a doll. She watched me for a year.
Please explain kind of what, like, the role that Tess plays, because I think it's very interesting, because, you know, this is the Kendra Brill story, from out of the ashes a phoenix emerges, and on the book it says that it's written by Tess DiCarlo, but that it's narrated by you. So please explain kind of how that relationship works and kind of what that writing process was like.
Tess is a transgender woman from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who has been a friend of mine through Facebook. Mm-hmm. That was my journal. Facebook's my journal. I have other social media sites. I have pretty much all of them, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. I'm on all of it as Kendra Brill. But she followed me through Facebook, and I wanted to reach more people, so I extended my social media and my YouTube. But I wanted to see, because people like to watch me. They like to see what I have to say, and that's what people told me. And I'm like, why, though? But because they're like your words. And I was with a family member and my boyfriend on New Year's Eve, and she told me earlier that day, it was actually the lady Trudy, the trans woman that's my mother, like my trans mother.
Mm-hmm.
She told me I should write a book. Her counselor, Abigail, Trudy's daughter, said Kendra should really write a book. Well, it was like Tess might have heard that, like, through the phone or something. It was so strange, because that night she said, do you want to write a book about your life? Because I'm going to do it. And that was my New Year's resolution, but I had asked out on a live feed on Facebook, like, I have all this information, I have all this stuff, I just don't know how. And I didn't want myself to represent me. I did narration through video, and I allowed Tess to really ask me some real stuff, as opposed to what she had already knew about me. And the first edit of the book, I was so displeased with it, because it wasn't my truth. It wasn't my conviction. It wasn't that. It was unsuredness, and that's not what I wanted. It was just that I was talking to her about the deepest, most darkest, and intimate places I've been in my life, the Craigslist prostitution, the, you know, infidelities I had, all the darkness that I lived, and I wanted to make sense of it. And then I have a book now, and it's beautiful, and I helped make the cover, and it's been a work in progress, because it wasn't something that she was really familiar with either, but she had information for lulu.com, and she started to write the book, and she would do a chapter, and the book started coming along so quick. And it's so weird because I'm big on numbers. Ones and sevens are really important to me right now because I was born on the 17th. Seven's my lucky number, mm-hmm. and one is a new number. So the 17th day of January, where I was thinking the book wouldn't be done until about spring, it still mm-hmm. might not be done until then. But I have so many people that are interested in reading whatever's in here. I've even had the book sent back to me to sign it and personalize it with letters saying what the book did for them, even if it wasn't right. And then I did some serious editing because Tess started to put things in it because she was the author. So she started putting stuff. So I say, you know, I'm going to end up having to write a book just to make clear because I don't want to hurt nobody by my book. We all have problems.
Sure.
But I want to be taken seriously. I'm planning on getting involved in politics. I'm planning on being a voice, an activist publicly. I would love to go into the penitentiaries because I know that there are so many broken and fallen souls that have no voice. That's why I come in, because I know what it's like. I know how people, LGBT, live in there, and I know what they do. And there's a lot of them that will just fall for anything, and they don't care, and they just have no joy or no moral value for their self. But if there were more, I had no information. I had no literature to read. When the only literature I had was a little packet from the WPATH that the doctor gave me, but they was really against me knowing anything about hormones or anything. Like, I would ask counselors to print stuff up. They were like, we're not allowed. I was thirsty for more knowledge. So hopefully my book would be so great. It's tucked away in the library somewhere and in the system for somebody to read, you know, because I know that that would just be so comforting to just lay back in the bunk and just read about this, because they don't know. People don't think that when they're in the penitentiary, they have rights, or they have you know, the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. That's violation. Mm-hmm. When they shaved my head, that was cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was so terrible for me to have to sit there and be humiliated publicly. But it's like Job in the Bible. That's my favorite book in the Bible, Job, because he endured mm-hmm. everything, but he never gave up his faith. And then God gave him back everything. And my God, I feel like that, you know, I feel like I've been just giving back everything I ever lost, and it's getting brighter and brighter, and big things are happening. People are watching and they're waiting for me to do the next thing. They're like, who is this girl from Virginia that did all of this? And I'm starting to realize people know me in California, New York, Minnesota. I'm like, wow. And people are watching and I'm like, this is really awesome because the message is getting out. God loves you. God loves you. Jesus loves you. That's all that matters. That's mm-hmm. what the scholars have taken the Bible. I learned this in the penitentiary when the people came in from the streets to give us church. One of the men said, you know, we've given the Bible to so many scholars, and we gave it to one in particular who was supposed to be a master. He had came back after reading the whole Bible and tried to interpret what it said. And the only thing he said was three words, Jesus loves me. That's it. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. So I got baptized in the prison, in a waiting pool after 40 men, but also got baptized real life with the people that I had encountered in my journey in life, that I have a spiritual mother and father now, Terry and Phillip, and they have a ministry called Longing for Eden. And we are bringing LGBT youth into our ministry to fix the damage that the church has done, the ones that feel like they aren't loved or that God don't love them. So it's our calling and our passion in life. And I've got charities, Casa Ruby. I was like, you know, I've got this book, and I know in my heart, you do something like this, and if you receive anything, it's because God led you on that journey. So I want to give back. I want to give to these. I want to give to my babies, these LGBT children that are lost, and I feel their pain. And I met one today, finally in public. I went and took him to lunch. He wants to help me, and he wants to be a part of my activism, and he wants to help me, you know. I want to do a community center or something so where we can do a larger outreach, because where I'm at in the four states region of Maryland, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Virginia, we're starting to see that each state is starting to rely on some of the resources from each other. And you know how the boundaries are set, the laws. I hate that. We have We should have one law, one love. Just do the right thing. Be a good human being and stop making things hard and just let people be who they are. But that's where I get angry with the imposters and these people out here who really, truly are getting in the way, really, of the progress that the LGBT has been doing for the last 30 years that I've been alive. And all of this hatred and all of this people wanting to dress up like, I guess, vaginas and go to women's marches. And that's not helping the children. It's confusing them even more, and it's misleading them, really. And I don't like it, and I'm not going to stand up to be a part of it, because anything anybody hates, I'm going to love it. So if you hate Donald Trump, I love him, because I'm going to believe that my God is going to put it on his heart to do the right thing. And I'm not going to keep promoting and feeding in to the hatred, because that's not helping. I'm going to be opposite of that, because I'll be seen more for being different. And that's how I feel anyways, because I don't promote hate. And people don't like me because of that. I've lost friends because of it. And you know what? You weren't my friend to begin with, because we shouldn't be friends based on religion, politics, or anything like that. We should be friends because we share a common bond and pain. And if you don't agree, then we'll just agree to disagree. It's simple. But people get caught up in things that if they did in the penitentiary where I was just at, it would have cost them their life. It would have cost them their life. They'd have got raped. They'd have got beaten. And they'd have learned very hard lessons. There are some real reckless people out in this world that just do not know what they're doing. And they're creating more problems right now than what we need. And I'm just going to say this. Caitlyn Jenner, I feel so sorry for her. I say she's my two-time hero in one lifetime. And it took her 6 decades to become herself. And she still did it, and she got judged. And that's wrong, because when I was growing up, she was a hero. She was still the same person. I could see that much into people. Like, I knew that there was something different, because pain and people who are really, like, affluent and winning victories are usually running from something. Look at Kristen Beck. She was putting herself in the scariest places in the world, not caring if she got killed, because she didn't love herself enough, I guess, to deal with what was really holding her back. Or like my transgender mother, Trudy. She is a heavy equipment operator, and she can drive excavators, and she would hang off the side of cliffs. She didn't care if she fell back down into the ravine and died. You know, so people put that fear into things, and they become successful. And that's what I guess is happening to me. All of the things I feared, I've manifested and dreamt of, and it's happened. So the joy and the victories were also dreamt. So I guarantee you that they're going to happen. And I just tell everybody, watch what happens to Kendra, because I have such a really good heart, and I love everybody. I do. I love everyone. And that doesn't always help me. But I know who to bring in and who not to. I don't open so many doors anymore.
Just for a minute, let's shift our focus onto something lighter. And what do you do to relax? Because you promoting a book and getting out there and doing signing events and doing all that stuff, it's taxing. And so, like, you know, I know that you have your faith family, and you've got some friends and things. But what is it that gets you, you know, what are things that you like to do that gets you getting up and going in the world that you look forward to every day? What do you do to have fun?
I like to shop. Money isn't very kind to me. I don't have it. So anyone who thinks that I am rich or anything like that, I might play the part well, but I can wear Gabriel Brothers and dollar store clothes really nice, as well as their makeup. I'm not one of them highfalutin people that I used to be as the person I was. I learned the value of a dollar, and I know giving back. So it's the charities that I'm involved in, the kids and talking. It's being accessible, because I'm gotten to a point now. I've been doing this for 2 years. I've taken on a really, really big role on Facebook as far as just being there for people as the deaf. I really have a hard time. People want to kill themselves. I'm so afraid to miss a message that might be somebody who needs me. That's always in the back of my mind. So it's hard for me to pull away from my phone, but I have decided that it is my time. I'd love to go on a vacation. I'd love to go somewhere warm. But now I'm just now reliving a new life, and it's really fresh. A year is not you know, a long time. So traveling, mountains, hiking, just walking on the CNO Canal, or going to spend time with my transgender daughter, Maya, who is also in the chapter of the book. She's an amazing girl. She's my daughter. I was in jail with her, and she started her travel at 18, and I knew she was trans. I knew it, and I just helped her get on hormones. I helped her. I didn't take anything from her, because I see people trying to do that, hold others back, and I didn't. I was like, come on. I got you an appointment. And so I try really hard to just give back, and I don't want no one to have to go through the same pain or differences that I have. And now she is. Her name change was denied in the court. So now we're dealing with that. It's always something. It's every day, you know? And so it's hard for me to really relax. It really truly is, because I guess I find solitude in just locking myself up in a room, kind of like being institutionalized a little bit. But that's why I write the best stuff. And I was a writer, truly. I am a writer.
Can you tell our listeners where they can purchase your book?
I have a couple copies that I have of the first edition on eBay. Or you can go to the link on Lulu and plug in Tess DiCarlo. Put her name in there.
Okay.
She's got two books now. One of them is called The T Words. And I'm in that book as well. It's about 12 different transgender individuals that have kind of done a lot this year, 2016 actually. Done so much for the community. And it's so different. That she's, I can't wait to see it. I don't know what that one's about, but we're still working to make mine a great book, not just a good book, a great one. And that was coming from my father. He said, you're capable of great. This book is just good. So come on, let's get it right. I have got that kind of encouragement in my life now. So that's where I'm at with that. So the book, if you have it posted always all over my Facebook page, the link.
Well, so speaking of which, if it's easier to just share your social media connections or your contact information so that folks can go find that, how would they find you on Facebook? Should they just look up Kendra Brill? Should they? Is there a specific like page for that is just for the book? Like, what's the easiest way for them to find it?
It's very easy. Just put in Kendra Brill, and you'll see. I mean, you'll see the my titles, the labels that have become me over these years. Prison reform. You'll see me with the picture right now. I'm actually, my Facebook picture is of me and Freddie Lutz, who owns Freddie's Beach Bar. That's where I just did a book signing at. And I'm going to do another one. This was just my first one right now, but I'm about to take off and come to different cities, and I'm going to talk to people. I've got quite an audience. I've met so many great people at Freddie's last Sunday night. And I've got some people I'm about to talk to, the Metropolitan Police Department, Washington, D.C., LGBT division, and talk to them about better ways that they can get next to the offenders and how they can ethically, you know, treat people in the jails through the booking processes. And those are things that I've done very, 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 very kindly myself. The last incarceration was for the 14 days. And when I went through booking, they was very respectful, and they asked me questions. They wanted to do it right. They wanted to make sure that I was given my hormones so that the jail did give me my hormones. So if I came in with them, I got them, and I did. I bought my own in, but they still ordered me their own anyways. But it was just that kind of stuff I am trying to ethically. How do you work with a transgender woman? Very naturally, just like you'd work with anybody else. Not no different. So you just got to show them. People don't know it unless they are actually in the presence. They'll fear what they don't know, as long as it was just like this for the homosexual, gay people, bisexual people, when they were going through that and people were so nasty to them, and it got real good for a long time. And now all of a sudden, bam, here we go, because of fear and change. And that's exactly what Donald Trump did. He did it on The Apprentice. He showed everybody how he is, how he works. So he's just going and just making waves. And I don't know. I just believe that I don't need anybody's law to govern my life. And I guess maybe that's because of being locked up and trying to govern my own self in the penitentiary and just managing my own life and what pertains to me instead of worrying about what goes on around everywhere else. That's the greatest lesson I could teach you. Worry about what is important to yourself, like truly important.
Since you mentioned exactly that as, you know, kind of like a almost like it felt like you were kind of giving some advice there. One of the things that I like to do at the end of all of my shows is I like to give my guests the last word. So this is your time to kind of, you know, take a moment, a quick moment, and just kind of tell our listeners anything that's on your heart or on your mind. Just what's the final thing that you'd like for folks to know?
I just maybe would say that many people in life start out well, but they end up progressing poorly because they don't plan for the pitfalls. But the Bible says the wise man looks ahead and faces reality. As we make plans for our future, we all face pitfalls, such as cultural distractions, voices of doubt, tempting shortcuts, and discouraging delays. Just look at Noah. He had pitfalls after God told him to build the ark, but he overcame them, and you can too. Pretty much the only way I can say it. Everybody is capable of this life. Everybody is deserving of God's love.
Well, thank you so much, Kendra. I wanna thank you so much for joining me for this show. Thanks to Kendra and my executive producer, as always, Anise Mabry, and of course, you, our listeners. This is Eli Strong, and you've been listening to The Strong Stance.